Hello and welcome to Bookmark on Cambridge 105 with me, Lee Chambers.
And me, Alex Rouget.
Hello, and today we've got an artist show, really, haven't we? We have got in the studio Susan Sellers, whose latest novel, Given the Choice, has just been published. We've got interviews with Diana Reich.
She's the director of the Small Wonder Festival, which is based at Charleston House. Near Lewis, which is a very arty place indeed.
Arty place. And I'll also be talking to Lynn Bryan, who's one of the organisers of Words and Women. So if we're talking about art, what was the last art exhibition you went to?
Put me on the spot now.
I have.
I think it was probably, like thousands of other people, David Hockney with at the Royal Academy, which might have been last year or the year before. So that's really appalling. But I do remember just being so bowled over by the colour and what I love about seeing an exhibition like that is just when you're sort of trying to be a creative person yourself and just see how other people are inspired by something. You know, the colours that he comes up with when he looks at that landscape are so unique to him and so beautiful and incredible. And it is hugely inspiring, and really, I ought to go more often. But how about you?
Well, no, I ought to go more often as well. I get gallery fatigue quite quickly, you know, as you're walking around. And then I feel awful because I'm walking past all these gorgeous paintings and I'm just thinking about, you know, where's the cafe? I want to sit down. But I think when you do go to an exhibition and it connects, it can be fantastic.
Yeah.
And the last one, well, it was some time ago. I remember going to see the Edvard Munch exhibition ages ago. It was when I was a student, actually, in Liverpool. And I wandered in, and I was in there hours, because actually it was a relatively small exhibition. But also, I just loved the work. And I came out feeling that I'd had this fantastic experience. And still now, when I see Munch's works, I sort of go back to that initial feeling. But, I don't often get that feeling, I have to say. I have to quite work at art.
Yeah, I'm not a lingerer over reading all the blurbs. I just want to see it and, you know, and look at it for a moment or two and think about it. But well, something like David Hockney, you're, you know, trundling along with thousands of other people and you really want to be able to be in there when there's no one else in there.
But
sadly, I'm not whoever, the Queen, so I can't do that.
But you're not?
No, not yet.
Well, the reason we're talking about art is because our studio guest is Susan Sellers, and both of her novels include artists. So, Susan, I'll put you on the spot now. What was the last art exhibition you went to?
I think the last big exhibition was the Pre-Raphaelites in London. But I was very interested in what you were saying about gallery fatigue, because actually what I really love doing is popping into a gallery and looking maybe at just 5 or 10 pictures and then coming away again. So, for instance, I spent a wonderful afternoon a couple of weeks ago in Kettle's Yard here in Cambridge, just wandering about and looking at a few things and sitting in front of them and staying with them. And I think for me, that's the really rewarding experience. Sometimes just sitting in front of one painting and watching it speak to you, almost like it becomes almost like a film experience, is really powerful and very refreshing if you're feeling jaded or tired. Certainly for me, it can pick me up.
I think that's right. That's good advice, actually, isn't
it's like
it?
Snacking on art, isn't it? Just popping in and rejuvenating yourself. Yeah, I think I'm going to do that. I haven't actually made it to Kettle's Yard yet, and I know they've got all the, and they've got a lot of St Ives artists in there. And we used to spend a lot of time down there, and going in any gallery there and seeing something like a Brian Pierce or any of those, I just love those. You know, the lightness of them is beautiful, isn't it?
And we are very lucky in Cambridge to have Kettle's Yard, because it is one of those extraordinary places where you can see the art as the owners intended it to be displayed. So, you know, it is literally on the wall of the living room, and there are places in Kettle's Yard where you can sit on the chairs that the owners would have sat in and enjoy the art from that point of view.
Oh, sitting on chairs, I like that.
Sitting on chairs. Yes. We'll have to come wait you up after half an hour, but that's fine.
So what is it about artists, Susan? Because, as I say, Vanessa in Virginia features the artist Vanessa Bell, and there's a French artist in your latest novel, Given the Choice. What is it about artists that intrigues you?
I think it is the fact that, for me, it is a completely unknown process. When I was researching Vanessa in Virginia, I knew that I wanted to write it from the point of view of Vanessa Bell, who was a very talented visual artist. And in order to research her, I went into studios and watched artists at work. And I became fascinated by the way a painting is built up from literally a blank canvas. And then there's a brushstroke here or a mark here. And gradually, over a few hours, something emerges from it. And it's quite extraordinary. And I think because writing is so slow and takes such a long time, and the accumulation is almost invisible. It was really exciting for me to watch that. And certainly in both of the novels, there is some reflection on process by using the two painters.
Fantastic. Well, we'll give you a proper introduction in a minute, but we're going to go to your first choice of music now, which leads in quite nicely from what you were saying. And what is it, Alex? It's
it is Vanessa and Virginia. Do you want, it's from your play, I think, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that quickly?
My partner is a composer, and he and I normally work on completely separate projects. And the Vanessa and Virginia toured as a stage play, and the theatre company responsible for it wanted some music, so my husband came involved in writing the music. So it's a very personal piece, not only because it represents a collaboration with my partner, possibly the only one we'll ever do, but also that piece of music immediately brings back the extraordinary journey of seeing the novel transformed into a stage play.
Hello and welcome back to Bookmark. I keep wanting to say Book Night, but it's Bookmark.
It is Bookmark.
Isn't it? On Cambridge 105. We've got Susan Sellers in the studio. I'm going to give her a proper introduction now. Susan Sellers is Professor of English and Related Literature at the University of St Andrews. She's written 16 books on writing and literary fiction. And in 2002, she won the Canongate Prize for Short Story Writing. And in 2007, received a new Writing Partnership Arts Council Award for her first novel, Vanessa and Virginia, which explored the relationship between the sisters, Vanessa Bell and Virginia Woolf. Her second novel, Given the Choice, has just been published by Cillian Press. So, Susan, what drew you to the story of Vanessa Bell and Virginia Woolf?
I'd been working on Virginia Woolf's writing as a scholar. I edit Woolf's work for Cambridge University Press. And that had led me to read and reread not only Virginia Woolf, but everything that had been written about her. And that took me to the correspondence with her sister Vanessa. And I realised how important that relationship was, that relationship as sisters. They grew up, their brothers were away at school, the parents were often busy. So there was a tremendous intensity in that relationship as they grew up, children and then young women. And that intensity remained throughout their lives. But it was a complicated relationship. They were certainly also jealous of each other on occasion, and they betrayed each other at certain points in their lives. And I think that idea of the relationship between the sisters became very, very compelling. And of course, there are questions. We don't know all the answers. And fiction seemed to me an arena in which it was possible to explore the things that we don't know ethically without saying it was definitely this or definitely that.
I don't have a sister. You have a sister, Alex, don't you? And it must have been quite hard because you're writing about two very iconic figures, but also sisters. And the relationship between them is different, isn't it, to the relationship that we know. The Virginia Woolf we know or think we know is very different to the Virginia Woolf who Vanessa knew.
Absolutely. And I think one of the wonderful things about writing the novel as opposed to lecturing about Virginia Woolf is that it has enabled me to perhaps present a different Virginia Woolf to a more general audience. I've loved talking to reading groups about the sisters. And on the back of that, sometimes they have read To the Lighthouse or Mrs. Dalloway. And as a scholar, there are all sorts of things that I know about Virginia Woolf, which simply don't make it into the public domain. For example, there is a myth that Woolf was largely uneducated, and yet she had the run of her father's library, extensive library. She had tutors in Greek and Latin. And we also discovered while I was working on this edition that she did degree level courses at King's College in London. So there are Virginia Woolf, as she is circulated in the popular imaginary, is actually very different to the Virginia Woolf who lived.
Did you consider doing a non-fiction book about the letters, or was it always the compulsion for you to do the fiction?
I think personally the compulsion was to do some fiction. I've always written fiction alongside my critical and scholarly work. And in fact, I'd been working on a short story about two sisters, and somehow those two ideas melded and the thing took off.
And having written fiction about Virginia Woolf and then going back to teaching her, did you find that it gave you a different perspective on her, that you felt more inside her head somehow?
I think we will never know the historical Virginia Woolf, and I think that's as it should be. But we do know an enormous amount about her, and one of the wonderful things is that she left so many diaries and so many letters, and they are full of all sorts of complications. For instance, she isn't always a very nice woman in the diaries. She can be incredibly bitchy about some of her friends and the people that she meets. So she's certainly a very, very complex figure, and I don't think we'll ever, ever get properly to the truth. But it's helped me, I think. I think students like the fact that I've written a novel and get a little bit more excited about that. Some of them have an idea that Virginia Woolf's going to be difficult and boring.
We are endlessly fascinated by her, aren't we? What do you think is the appeal of Virginia Woolf?
She was, first and foremost, an extraordinary writer who changed the kinds of books that we read today. I mean, I think we can trace the influence of fiction right back to some of the experiments that she was conducting. But I also think she was such an interesting woman in so many different ways. And I think that's very compelling. Certainly for me as a woman, that's very compelling to find someone so complicated and so interesting and so contrary.
Got so many questions.
So many questions. You go first.
I was going to ask you, did you get to the bottom, do you think, of why they took different paths, why Vanessa became an artist and Virginia became a writer? Was there any sort of discoveries about that in those letters?
there is a sense in which Virginia Woolf did do some early drawing, but I think it was very quickly established between the two sisters that Virginia Woolf was going to be a great writer and Vanessa Bell was going to be a great painter. That kind of negotiation that takes
place. The separation.
Place. Yes.
Okay.
Because Vanessa Bell is perhaps the more mysterious of the two. I mean, we know a lot about Virginia Woolf, relatively. How did you go about finding out more about Vanessa Bell? I guess her paintings were for you one of the main sources.
They were. She has left correspondence. I mean, the two sisters corresponded daily throughout their lives. I think it was a little bit like texting or emailing, perhaps. And so we can read the letters. But her correspondence is, I think, less revealing than that of Virginia Woolf's. And it tends to, I think, be a little bit more prosaic. So it really was the paintings that gave me some sense of her, and also reading biographies about her incredible life, full of tragedy, but also extraordinary resilience.
Well, I think we've got much more to ask you about both this, Vanessa and Virginia, but that leads us nicely to our next interview. I actually interviewed Diana Reich, director of the Small Wonder Festival at Charleston, which was actually Vanessa Bell's and Duncan Grant's country home, where the Bloomsbury Group often went. This Small Wonder is a short story festival that takes place at the end of September. So I interviewed Diana then. I asked her about the festival, and please forgive the very authentic setting up of the festival, bumping and stuff going on in the background.
Well, this is the 10th anniversary of Small Wonder this year, and I've been involved since its inception, so it doesn't feel like it, but it must be 10 years.
And so your role as director, are you responsible for the programming?
Yes, I'm entirely responsible for putting the programme together, but then I rely on a great team down here to implement the programme, or at least to help me to implement the programme, certainly from the point of view of the practicalities, although I still look after the authors here. So my role is to make sure that the authors know what they're doing, that I give them guidelines, that I support them before, and I support them when they come off the stage.
And what are you most proud of in the last 10 years, do you think?
Oh, well, I'm most proud of the fact that Small Wonder, the festival, has been part of a campaign to champion the short story. At the time that we decided to found Small Wonder, the short story genre was languishing to a certain extent as far as publication was concerned, and as far as readers were concerned, as if it's not published, then it's not going to be read. But writers were telling us that they enjoyed writing short stories, that they had short stories in their drawers, but the publishers were not welcoming them, and they were asking for novels, and it was just a vicious circle. So we were consciously part of a campaign to reinvigorate the short story, and the fact that, and I think that has happened, what should I say, reinvigorate interest in the short story, and I think that we wouldn't obviously claim all the credit for that, but I think we have participated in that campaign, and I think that has been successful, and I do feel very positive about that.
And have you seen audiences grow for the festival?
Yes, the festival has now really become part of the sort of the local landscape, and you know, there is a strong awareness of Small Wonder. It has a very particular identity that you'll probably have noticed, but that it tends to be perhaps more interactive, perhaps possibly a little bit more experimental than an average literature festival. But yes, certainly it has grown, and in fact this year it's a day longer than it's been in the past. It used to be a four-day festival, but this year it's 5 days.
That's fantastic. And you've also launched a new award this year. Can you tell us about that?
Well, we thought we wanted to do something special, symbolic, to mark the 10th anniversary. There are lots of short story awards and prizes, two very prestigious ones. started got off the ground, should I say, a year or two after Small Wonder, sort of part of the campaign. One of which is the Sunday Times Short Story Award, which is for an individual story, and the other is the BBC Award, which is for a collection. We wanted to value those, so we wanted to try and think of something that was distinctive and didn't exist at all. So what we came up with was the idea of presenting award for a lifetime's achievement in or a lifetime's excellence in writing short story. We won't necessarily, this will vary from year to year, it wouldn't necessarily have to go to someone at the end of their lifespan, we would be awarding it for someone who had a record of publishing short stories, although it might be also novels, non-fiction as well.
Who are your personal favourites, can you tell us, in short story writing?
Oh, do you mean contemporary or...
anyone.
Contemporary. Who do I love? Well, I love a very wide range. I think there's a particular energy at the moment. If we're talking about contemporary story, there's a particular energy in stories written by people who... through circumstances are outsiders. So I'm thinking of Jhumpa Lahiri, who was here. I don't know whether you heard her yesterday.
Here, yes.
Okay. Well, actually, she read from her novel, which is understandable because that's what she's just published and it's book shortlisted. But her short stories are completely amazing. And it's interesting that she comes from a tradition of short story writers, such as, for example, William Trevor, who she admires a great deal, who is an Irish short story writer, but writes from outside Ireland. And the same would be true of James Joyce's stories, for example, that he's known for his novels, but he's a wonderful short story writer. And even someone like Chekhov, who continued to write about Russia, but not from the area in which he was brought up. Obviously, I admire Chekhov. But I've just mentioned one other short story writer who writes maybe more in the tradition that I mentioned regarding Jhumpa. She's a Chinese writer now living in America, the same sort of age as Jhumpa, Yuin Li, who's also an amazing short story writer.
That was Diana Wright then from Small Wonder Festival. You're listening to Bookmark. We have Susan Sellers in the studio with us. Tell us a bit about Charleston for anybody who doesn't know, because that's where Small Wonder is based, and it is a wonderful place, isn't it?
It is the most magical place. It was the home of Vanessa Bell, and she took it when things were quite desperate in her life and there was very little money, and possibly as a result of that, but possibly also just because it was a wonderful thing to do, she decorated the house. And when I say decorated, I don't just mean walls.
Magnolia.
And every single thing in the house is painted, decorated, either by Vanessa Bell or by her artist friends, and the effect is just extraordinary. I mean, even a coal scuttle, which was probably made from a few bits and pieces of wood, has this extraordinary decoration on it. So it just kind of sings in front of the fireplace, and everything is like that. And yet the extraordinary thing is, it's not overwhelming. It's actually uplifting. So although there's decoration everywhere, it doesn't have that kind of baroque sense of this is a bit too much. It's really, really absorbing and quite wonderful.
It is a special place, and the actual Small Wonder Festival takes place in the barn, and even that, I mean, it's not decorated or anything like that, but just the light and the atmosphere in there, and all the writers, they get to go into the kitchen for the green room. I didn't manage to wheedle my way in there, unfortunately, but You know, I could hear them talking. DBC Pierre was chatting away, and he was saying, this is such a special place. And they were all, I think part of the reason that they get people like Jhumpa Lahiri to come and speak, and actually quite a small festival, you know, in Lewis, in the middle of the countryside, is because of that place and it being so special.
And the garden as well. Yes. It's a painter's garden, yeah. So it's quite extraordinary.
And they had some pretty fantastic guests there as well, didn't they? Lots. I mean, anyone who was anyone at that time seemed to come to Charleston.
That's right, and very distinguished people actually had rooms there. I mean, Maynard Keynes had a room in the house, and I think it was full of life, full of parties, full of all sorts of extraordinary events and happenings. I think it must have been a very creative, extraordinary place.
It was full of tangled relationships, wasn't it? I mean, there was a lot going on there.
It was, and yet I think one of the things that's extraordinary about the Bloomsbury Group is that they weren't at all interested in being celebrities. So it's the complete antithesis to some of the worst aspects of celebrity culture that we're in now. But also, they believed passionately in friendships. That was really important to them. And I think both of those things, we could learn from that.
Absolutely. I'm going to have another piece of music now. I'm going to pronounce it wrong. Desafinado, is that right? Do you want to tell us why you chose this?
When I was a younger woman, I spent quite a lot of time in Paris, and everybody I knew was playing Stan Getz. And so whenever I hear this piece of music, it immediately conjures up being in Paris, being right at the start of my career with all that that meant in terms of anxieties, but also possibilities. So it's a piece of music that I still find quite emotionally inspiring.
Se você disser que eu desafino amor, saiba que isto em mim provoca imensa dor. Só privilegiados têm ouvido igual ao seu. Eu possuo apenas o que Deus me deu. Se você insiste em classificar meu comportamento diante musical, eu mesmo mentindo devo argumentar que isto é bossa nova, que isto é muito natural. Que você não sabe, nem sequer presente, é que os desafinados também têm coração. Fotografei você na minha Rolleiflex, revelou-se a sua enorme ingratidão. Só não poderá falar assim do meu amor, ele é o maior que você pode encontrar, viu? Você com a sua música esqueceu o principal, que no peito dos desafinados, no fundo do peito bate calado. No peito dos desafinados também bate um coração.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Bookmark. We've got Susan Sellers in the studio, and Susan, you're going to read something for us now.
I've chosen a passage from Given the Choice, partly because it's actually published today as we're recording the show. The central character is a complicated woman. She owns her own agency, promotion agency for artists. And in the passage I'm going to read, she's listening to a young Estonian pianist, and he's playing some of the extraordinary bird sketches that the composer Messiaen wrote for the piano. Peter placed his hands over the keys. Suddenly, the piano was alive. Marion settled back in her chair and closed her eyes. She did not know what she was listening to, but within moments she was transported out of her surroundings into a dense jungle of sound. The piano was no longer a music-making machine, but the source of a magical power. She could hear the swooping calls of birds as they darted through treetops or skimmed and dived in a free expanse of air. The bare walls of the practice room had metamorphosed into an enchanted forest, teeming with flashes of brilliant plumage and abrupt, raucous caws. As she opened her eyes, she was reminded of the monastery of San Marco in Florence, its plain white cells transfigured by Fra Angelico's art. She thought of the ritual of Peter's daily practice. The long hours he spent at the keyboard required the same devotion the monks expended in prayer. When Peter finally stopped playing, she felt as if he had taken her to a world beyond herself, where she had glimpsed something extraordinary. It was a feeling she sometimes had when she looked at art.
Thank you, Susan. You say she's a complicated woman. I mean, she's actually downright unlikable at points, Marion. That's quite a brave decision to make the heroine of your novel not the most nice of people.
She was partly inspired by a character I came across while I was in Paris, who was an extraordinary successful, sassy businesswoman, and who was charming and beautiful and constantly had this circle of adoring people around her. And yet, if you stood back, was very, very good at manipulating everything around her. And I think there was a kernel taken from her. But I really liked the idea of a protagonist, particularly a woman, who is generous on occasion, but who is also capable of lying when the odds are stacked up against her. I really like the idea of taking someone a bit more rounded and a bit complicated. And it had a second advantage, which meant that I didn't want my readers to empathise too closely with her. I wanted them to stand back a little and be a little bit outside of who she is, so that when you get to the ending, and I don't want to give any spoilers, you don't particularly have a great desire for it all to go well.
I don't want to give any spoilers either, but am I allowed to say there are multiple endings? The reader does have a choice. Why did you do that?
When I finished what I thought was the book, in fact, it probably was draft number 5, I ended it with a very kind of real-life ending that was messy and inconclusive, and where the central character doesn't learn the lessons she should. So we get a sense that some of those mistakes, if you like, are going to continue to echo and reverberate for the characters in the novel. And when I sent it out to readers, they were intrigued, but they also wanted more of an outcome. And so I was also working on the painter, and he was working on a triptych of 3 paintings, and they were all about the same subject, but they were different because of very small adjustments in each of the paintings. And I realised that I could do something similar with the endings. And so what you have is an ending where she gets her comeuppance, if you like, and also one where things turn out more happily, albeit with a kind of twist.
So the idea is that the reader can choose their favourite. Do you have a favourite?
I don't, actually. I don't. I still like my real-life ending, but I got more and more involved in the other ones too. And then, of course, that became the title, given the choice, because the book is also about a big life choice, so it kind of echoed in that way as well.
Well, we've got more questions to ask you about that, but we'll go to an interview now. Lynn Bryan is one of the organisers of Words and Women, and I met her in a very busy and buzzing library, as you'll hear, in Cambridge. I started by asking her what Words and Women is.
Words and Women is an organisation that promotes and celebrates women writers. It's for women in the east of England, but essentially at the moment we're based in Norwich. But it's about celebration of women's writing skills and achievements and promotion of their books, their readings, any kind of writing event. We're open to members. We're trying to branch out into the whole of the east of England, and we've launched a writing competition, and we've got lots of kind of exciting events planned for 2014 that we're trying to fundraise for at the moment.
And why do women need a special organisation?
I think it's really nice for women to get together. It's actually nice to be in a room with a group of women. There's a kind of freedom to that. And primarily, it was about that. It was just like going out with your girlfriends and having a really good night. You know, there's still a case for having a women's organisation just to keep women's voices out there.
Because men might say, well, it's difficult being a writer whether you're a man or a woman. Why are women getting all the help?
Oh, absolutely. It's hard work being a writer, and the business, particularly publishing, is going through enormous upheaval. Are women getting all the help? I don't know. But we're just a couple of women that have set up an organisation because we want to, and that's not kind of stopping chaps from doing the same thing.
What are the membership benefits?
We've just launched the membership this year. For £10, we are running 2 events that are exclusively for women only. Our big main events are for men, women and children to come along to. We've always had great mixed audiences. But we wanted to have some specific women-only events where you can go along and network and meet women writers in the region to sort of reduce feelings of isolation. We're hoping there'll be more benefits as the time goes on. We're launching an anthology, so probably members will get a discount on the anthology.
Your own background, Lynn, is really interesting. You established, was it a magazine called Harpies and Quines? What was that? Is that how you pronounce it?
Harpies and Quines was a Scottish feminist magazine, because I was based in Glasgow in the 1990s. It was just, again, a group of women who wanted to produce a magazine for women for the whole of Scotland. It was quite political. It was also sued by Harpers and Queens, so we were under a lawsuit because they challenged our use of the name. I think they thought we were kind of spoiling their brand. Harpies and Quines are strident kind of women. They're Scottish words for strident, strong warrior women. It was great fun. We produced some really great material. It lasted for 2 years because we got so exhausted. It was a lot of work. And also there comes to a point in a business where you need a lot of money and we hadn't got it, basically. And I'm hearing that they're thinking about bringing it back.
So since then, what changes have you seen in writing by women and the opportunities for women writers?
I've been talking about visibility, and I think that it is more visible now. I think women writers are far more visible. I was thinking that perhaps what's happened is that there's become more kind of niche places or more branches of writing that women seem to be writing for, so like chick lit. I was thinking of Sarah Waters, actually. See, she's a really interesting example. My agent is also her agent, so I kind of know that the struggle her work had initially to get out there. And it was brought out by a women's press, Virago, because nobody else was interested in a lesbian crime thriller. And now she's a huge brand name. So I think there's more niches and there's more well-known women within those niches, so I think that's great. I'm not too sure whether literary fiction is still expansive enough for women. That still feels quite male-dominated to me.
And you're a novelist and a short story writer. What inspires you to write?
A desperate need. Desperate need. I can't identify what this need is.
Attention, money?
I think it's attention. It's definitely not money. I think it's just something that makes me feel healthy. If I'm not writing, I feel very unhealthy and very fidgety, very agitated. So I have to at least do an hour a day if I can.
Is that your usual process, that you sit down at some point?
At some point I have to get something done. Even if I've had a full day of, I work for the UEA, I do a lot of teaching. I also have a family. But even if it's midnight and I'm not written, I sit down and I make sure that I write something.
Just to keep yourself ticking over, just to keep that
part of your
brain alive.
Keep myself ticking over and keep saying to myself, well, this is who I am. I am a writer. Yeah, it's that kind of need to actually get some sentences down.
And your own favourites. Who are your favourite women writers?
Well, my favourite women writers, I love women writers. Rachel Cusk, I think, is tremendous. I like writing with a lot of energy and voice to it. I like really hearing a strong voice. So Rachel Cusk, because I think she cares about writing, but I think she doesn't mind offending, and that appeals. And I like A.M. Holmes for the same reason. She doesn't mind offending, which is great. And Faye Weldon for the same reason. It's naughty women. I like naughty women writers. But also I'd like to mention a male writer who I'm crazy about at the moment is Kevin Barry. I think he is absolutely terrific, and if anyone can get any of his short stories, then please do.
That was Lynn Bryan, the organiser of Words and Women. She was talking about the writing process there, Susan, doing an hour a day. You have a very similar life to her. You divide your time between St Andrews and Cambridge, and you have a family. What's your writing process? How do you find time to do it?
I would love to be able to say that I write in a disciplined way for an hour a day, and I'm completely admiring of the interview that we've just heard. In reality, I'm a binge writer. Mm-hmm. I think I kind of, build it up and build it up and build it up, and then just clear the space and it takes priority. I don't seem to be able to do it alongside the day job very easily, if you like. So I kind of store it up, and then I think it just kind of, as I say, becomes this overwhelming determination. But I think you do have to have a certain faith and perhaps also a small streak of ruthlessness. There has to be a point when you stop answering emails and doing all of those other things and think, no, actually, if I'm not going to lose this idea, I have to sit down and do something about it now.
And you made it hard for yourself in given the choice, because you're writing from four perspectives. Is it all four quite different perspectives? How did you do that? Did you write each story by itself and then put them all together, or did you do it one chapter after another?
I tend to write a first early draft as quickly as possible. And I think there's something about tricking the senses, if that makes any sense. If I sit down and think, nobody's going to see this version, this is just play, this is just for me, I'm just going to fire on all cylinders and see what happens. So I tend to end up with a big baggy, misshapen thing. And I know that all the writing advice is start with a plan, start with a synopsis. I just can't do that. I have to have lots and lots and lots of material and then look at the material and start seeing what the shapes are and where the interesting stories are. And then I kind of pull those out and hone and hone and hone and hone. So I'm a very inefficient writer, really. I think I write far more than is strictly required, but that seems to be my process.
You're an incredibly accomplished and driven person, Susan. I'm certainly picking that up from listening to you, and also from all the stuff that you've published. I mean, how did you come to be? Where did all this creative spark come from? What was your upbringing? What inspired you?
I came from a household with no books, so I can't say I grew up in a literary environment. But I think I've just always loved words. I've just always loved the way that words fall together and play together. And I think as a result of that, I was drawn to reading. And although my parents weren't book readers, they didn't stop me from reading as a child. And so I did. Local libraries were crucial. Going to local libraries and browsing and bringing books home for free, that was quite extraordinary. So I think perhaps there.
And then, of course, you went off on your travels. So you went to Paris. Tell us about that.
Yes, I went to Paris while I was still a doctoral student and was only supposed to go for a year. But while I was there, and I was working on Virginia Woolf, but while I was there, I came across all sorts of extraordinary French feminists, people like Hélène Cixous and Julia Kristeva and Luce Irigaray, who were writing all these quite extraordinary feminist pieces of polemic. And I was lucky enough to end up working with Hélène Cixous and translating some of her books, and I ended up staying 7 years.
Wow. Oh, 7 years in Paris. Yeah. Also on your CV, it says you co-wrote a film script with a Hollywood screenwriter. It's just kind of thrown in there, as you do. What was that?
Yes, this was someone who, I came across in Paris, and he had worked for a television series called Cheers. He was a writer for that, and he had come to Paris to research a new script, and he advertised for a woman, a young woman who was a native English speaker who'd been living in Paris for a sufficiently long amount of time that he could kind of draw on for research. But in fact, I ended up getting very involved in the process of writing the script, which was fascinating, but also quite frustrating, because you can have so very few words in a script. Everything has to be boiled down to the minimum.
And what happened to that script?
I don't think it ever got made, but apparently that's what happens. You know, you research, you write. I think options were bought on it, but the number of option scripts that actually make it into production.
And should you've also been... Oh, sorry, I was just going to ask you about Peru.
Wasn't that
on the CV?
Peru. Yes,
should
Peru.
We do Peru now?
We will do Peru.
Tell us about your travels in Peru.
Yes, well, I also had the opportunity to... I went to Swaziland for a year and did some teaching there, which was absolutely fascinating. I remember vividly teaching Tess of the D'Urbervilles, and I don't know whether you remember in Tess of the D'Urbervilles, but one crucial element is when Tess falls pregnant, and of course she's castigated by her society. Now, the women I was teaching to couldn't understand this at all, because as far as they were concerned, this was an extraordinary proof of fertility and made her even more attractive on the marriage market. So, you know, it was just extraordinary. And then I did indeed go to Lima in Peru and worked for an American women's aid agency in Peru.
Wow, fantastic. Well, we're going to have some more music. If we can squeeze it in between all the questions we still have. We've got Joni Mitchell. Can you tell us why you chose this?
Joni Mitchell was one of a number of powerful women singer-songwriter that I just loved as I was growing up. And I chose this track because she's a wordsmith, and I think that comes across here. ¶¶
sip. Take me to the dance. Do you wanna dance? I love to dance. And I told him they don't take chances. They seem so removed from romance. They've been broken in churches and schools and molded to middle class circumstance. And we were rolling, rolling, rocking. Just kissing in cars, kissing in cafes. And they were walking down Main Street, kisses like bright flags hung on holidays. In France they kiss on Main Street, amour, mama, not cheap display. And we were rolling, rolling, rocking.
Welcome back to Bookmark on Cambridge 105. We've got novelist Susan Sellers in the studio with us. Susan, you were saying your new book comes out today, given the choice on Killian Press, not Cillian Press, Killian Press. That's very exciting. It's your second novel. Did you find it a different experience writing the second novel after writing the first? I mean, they are very different novels, although both of them have different voices in them.
I remember very vividly at the launch of Vanessa in Virginia here in Heffers, just as it was finishing, a friend saying to me, of course, what's really difficult is writing the second novel. And I remember laughing and thinking at the time, how can anything be more difficult than writing the first novel? But actually, he was right. I think with Vanessa and Virginia, it was a labour of love. I plunged in and I didn't really think too closely about how I did it. With Given the Choice, I seemed to see the pitfalls in flashing neon even before I kind of tumbled into them. It was a much more difficult book for me personally. I think I had a kind of an awareness about what I was doing that I didn't really have with the first one. I am somebody who in any case goes through many, many, many drafts, but this one, well, you can tell by the dates. I mean, it's taken me quite a few years to get it to the point where I think, no, it works. It's ready now to go out.
And it's about a difficult subject. I mean, one of the main themes in it is about childlessness, having children. And you look at a woman who doesn't really want to have children and a man who does. Why did you explore those themes?
Well, I think that there isn't enough written about this crucial, crucial life choice, whether or not to become a parent. And of course, it's such a complicated choice because so many factors come into play. often for women, that choice needs to be made at a time when the career is all-consuming. There are often financial implications, although I kind of removed those for this novel because it's set in the art world, so it's a very moneyed world. There are biological reasons, and those, of course, are different for men and for women. You know, it's still the case that it's very, very difficult for women to have a child after 40. And I really wanted to explore that choice and also some of the ways that that choice could be thought of. You know, for instance, women having a child on their own, gay men getting together and parenting. What happens if you can't physically produce a child? Adoption or what? So just the issues around that.
And it is a very different book, as Lee said, in many ways, to Vanessa and Virginia. I mean, did you have any conversations with your publisher? I mean, I know you're with a sort of small independent publisher, which is great, because I think you can probably have more freedom there. But we're going to be talking in our Festival of Ideas event about genre and about categorisation. And I mean, did they have a conversation about where your books fall exactly and where they place you in the genres?
I loved working with my first publisher, Two Ravens Press, but they have now gone down the ecological route. They're much more interested in books now about the environment. So when I finished Given the Choice, I was looking for a publisher, and I think I write in quite a tricky way. Vanessa and Virginia is written as a kind of elegy to Virginia by Vanessa. So some of it's in the second person, although it's interspersed with Vanessa's memories. Given the Choice, as we've discussed, is about this tricky central character, and it has very deliberately a choice of endings for the reader. So I don't think I write in a way that's mass marketed in the way that publishers now seem to need. So for me, it's very, very important that there are lively, bold, independent presses who are prepared to take risks.
Absolutely. And what was also interesting for me was the way, particularly in Vanessa and Virginia, the way you take on the voice of Vanessa. How is that as a writer? Because people are always talking about finding your own voice, but you're actually writing, in a way, in someone else's voice.
I think that's very important. I think for me, I suppose you were asking about genre. I suppose I write literary fiction with a slight experimental bent to it. And of course, literary fiction is the genre of character. And so finding the voice of the book is crucial. And finding Vanessa's voice, I knew I didn't want to write Virginia Woolf's voice, because I knew that it might turn out in some kind of terrible pastiche. So finding Vanessa, who was the more silent of the two sisters, really worked for me. In Given the Choice, it was a completely different problem because it's very contemporary, and the voice had to be much more restrained. I didn't have the rich palette of language that I felt I had with Vanessa and Virginia. And I also had to find a voice of, as we've talked about, a not particularly endearing heroine.
Was it quite liberating, though, in Given the Choice? Because Vanessa and Virginia was about real people, you must have felt that a little bit restricted by what you could write, whereas in Given the Choice, you can say anything because they're in your head, they're made-up characters. So that must have been a little bit liberating, was it?
Yes, it was. Although it's interesting because I noticed that there are, in Given the Choice, there are some real people. Damien Hirst makes a kind of walk-on appearance, etc. So I think I am very much in the kind of crossover between real life and fiction. But no, you're right. If you have invented characters, then you, or rather sometimes they, decide all sorts of things about what's going to happen.
Well, thank you very much, Susan, for coming into the studio. Given the Choice is available from Killiam Press. And what's your next book? Are you writing the next one?
I am. It's actually going to be set in Paris.
Oh, lovely.
So you've got to do lots of research in Paris.
Yes. Definitely.
We're available as research assistants.
Oh, for bag carrying,
yes,
anything.
Yes.
Well, our next show is, well, your studio guest is Tim Dee. He's a landscape writer. And we've also got interviews with Alex Mellenby, who's a fellow stablemate of yours at Killian Press, and he's written a fantasy fiction novel for young teenagers. And I've also got an interview with the curator of Chawton, which is Jane Austen's home in Hampshire. So until then...
Enjoy your books. No, I've stolen your strapline.
That is my...
Keep listening, I'll say.
Keep listening. can I say my...
You say
everybody's
yours,
saying it, you know.
I know.
All the streets of Cambridge.
It has caught on, I have to say. I hear it wherever I go. But
in every bookshop.
Yeah.
But never delivered as well as me.
No one says it like you, so yeah.
Enjoy your books.